A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking whether it's true that the U Army keeps warehouses around the world stocked with tanks, ammunition, and supplies just waiting for a conflict, how often they actually get used, and what it takes to keep all that gear from rusting into oblivion. Short answer, yes, absolutely true. Long answer, it's one of the most expensive, painstaking, and overlooked logistics operations on Earth, and it's the reason that Brigade can go from standing on American soil to fighting in Eastern Europe in about a week instead of 3 months.
The timing on this question is sharp. The war in Ukraine has been a 2-year stress test of NATO's ability to move heavy armor across a continent, and the Pacific pivot is forcing a complete rethink of where and how you store Brigade's worth of tanks when the nearest friendly port is 1,000 miles from the fight. These stockpiles went from nice to have to the entire plan, faster than most people realize.
What exactly are these warehouses, and how did they come to be?
The program is called Army Preposition Stocks, APS for short, and it's not just random caches of gear. Each APS set is a complete, combat-ready brigade's worth of equipment. We're talking 58 M1 Abrams tanks, about 90 Bradley fighting vehicles, 4,000 trucks and support vehicles, plus 30 days of ammunition, fuel, medical supplies, and rations. Soldiers fly in with their personal weapons and the uniforms on their backs. Everything else, everything, is waiting for them in climate-controlled warehouses or aboard ships.
The idea is you airlift the humans, not the tanks. Humans are light. Tanks are 70 tons each.
A C-17 Globemaster can carry one Abrams tank, and it burns about 20,000 pounds of fuel per hour doing it. To move an entire armored brigade by air would take hundreds of sorties and weeks. The preposition model collapses that timeline from months to days. The Army's target is to have a brigade fully equipped and combat-ready within 96 hours of soldiers touching down at the APS site.
96 hours. That's a long weekend.
That's the promise. Whether they can actually hit that number in a real crisis is one of those questions that keeps logistics officers up at night. But the architecture is built around that ambition.
Let's crack open the doors on a few of these facilities and see what's really inside.
There are 5 APS sets globally, designated APS 1 through APS 5, and they're positioned in Europe, the Pacific, and the Middle East. The total value of equipment across all 5 sets is estimated at about $30 billion. APS 2 is the big one in Europe. It's headquartered in Mannheim, Germany, with major storage sites in Zutendaal, Belgium, plus facilities in the Netherlands and Poland. APS-2 alone includes 3 full brigade sets, enough to equip roughly 15,000 soldiers.
3 brigades just sitting in warehouses in Belgium and Germany.
Those warehouses are something else. We're not talking about dusty Quonset huts. The Zutendaal site is a massive climate-controlled complex. Temperature and humidity are tightly regulated because you're storing sensitive electronics, optical systems on tanks, rubber seals, medical supplies. Every vehicle in storage has its fuel tanks full, stabilized fuel, treated with additives to prevent degradation, and its batteries on trickle chargers.
Full fuel tanks? So these things are ready to start and drive out the door?
That's the idea. But ready to start and drive is where the maintenance story gets wild. Every single vehicle in APS must be started, driven, and exercised on a monthly basis. You can't just park a tank for 3 years and expect it to work. Rubber seals dry out and crack. Lubricants settle and congeal. Batteries die even on trickle chargers. Tires develop flat spots. Fuel grows microbial colonies. There's actually a thing called diesel bug, bacteria and fungi that thrive in the water-fuel interface inside tanks.
Of course, there's a diesel bug.
It's a real problem. If it gets into the fuel lines, it clogs filters and corrodes injectors. The Army tests fuel samples from every stored vehicle quarterly. They also rotate tires to prevent flat spotting, inspect ammunition for corrosion, cycle the turret hydraulics on the tanks, run the engines up to operating temperature to boil off moisture in the oil. The 21st Theater Sustainment Command, which manages APS-2 in Europe, employs about 2,000 civilians and contractors full-time just for maintenance and caretaker duties. 2,000 people whose entire job is keeping parked tanks ready to fight.
That's a small city of mechanics doing monthly joyrides in Abrams tanks in Belgium.
It's not just the vehicles. Ammunition has its own maintenance cycle. Propellant degrades over time, especially in heat. Artillery shells and tank rounds have to be inspected, rotated, and periodically replaced. The Army tracks the shelf life of every lot of ammunition in the system, and when something gets too old, it gets pulled, shipped back for demilitarization, and replaced with fresh stock. That rotation alone is a multi-million-dollar annual line item.
How often are these stocks actually drawn down for something real?
More often than you'd think, but less often than the maintenance schedule would suggest. The big recent example is Operation Atlantic Resolve, which started in 2014 after Russia's first invasion of Ukraine. Began rotating armored brigades through Eastern Europe on 9-month deployments, and those brigades drew equipment directly from APS-2. Soldiers flew into Germany, picked up their tanks and Bradleys from Mannheim and Zutendal, and drove them east to Poland and the Baltic states.
They actually used the preposition gear for real deterrence missions.
And that created a paradox that's at the heart of the APS model. Every time you draw down a brigade set, you have to reconstitute it afterward. That means bringing in replacement equipment, inspecting and repairing everything that was used, restocking ammunition and supplies. The reconstitution process takes 6 to 12 months and costs between $50 and $100 million per brigade set. So using the stocks makes them unavailable for the next crisis until they're rebuilt.
Use it or lose it, but in slow motion.
That tension drives a lot of the strategic decision-making. Do you draw down APS-2 for a training exercise in Poland, knowing it'll take a year to rebuild? What if a real crisis erupts in the Pacific 6 months later and you need that gear? The Army has been wrestling with this since 2014, and the answer has largely been, invest more. In 2022, the Army prepositioned a full brigade set in Poland for the first time, a $350 million investment that cut deployment time for that region from 60 days to 7.
That's the difference between a deterrent and a rescue mission.
The Poland site is now permanent. It's part of APS-2's expansion, which also includes new storage facilities in the Netherlands and upgrades to the Mannheim and Zutendal sites. The Army requested $1.2 billion for APS modernization in the 2027 budget. That's not maintenance, that's expansion and upgrading.
Having all that gear is one thing. Keeping it ready is another beast entirely.
Here's where things get uncomfortable. A 2025 Government Accountability Office report, that's GAO 25225-DUNO-6487 for anyone who wants to look it up, found that APS-2 had an equipment readiness rate of 73%. That means more than a quarter of the gear needed repairs before it could be considered combat ready. Some of that is normal. Vehicles in storage always have issues, but 73% is below the Army's own readiness targets.
Nearly one in three tanks or Bradleys in the European stockpile isn't ready to fight. That's a pretty significant asterisk on the 96-hour promise.
The GAO was not gentle about it. They flagged maintenance backlogs, part shortages, and staffing gaps at the caretaker facilities. The Army's response was that readiness rates fluctuate and that they prioritize the most critical combat systems, so the tanks might be at 85% while the support trucks are at 60%. But still, when you're selling Congress on a $30 billion insurance policy, 73% is not the number you want on the brochure.
What about the other APS sets? You mentioned APS-3 is on ships.
APS-3 is the maritime component. It's stored aboard Maritime Prepositioning Ships, or MPS, operated by the Navy's Military Sealift Command. There are 13 of these ships, stationed primarily at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean and at Guam in the Pacific. Each ship carries enough equipment for a Marine Expeditionary Brigade, about 15,000 Marines, and the ships themselves cost roughly $1.5 million per year to maintain in what's called layup status, which is basically floating storage with a skeleton crew.
The gear is literally floating around the ocean, waiting.
That solves one problem while creating several others. The big advantage of PREPO afloat is that you avoid host nation political friction. You don't need a basing agreement with Belgium or Poland or Kuwait. The ships are sovereign U territory sitting in international waters or at a leased anchorage. If a crisis erupts and a host nation gets skittish about allowing U forces to stage from their soil, the ships can just sail somewhere else.
The floating loophole.
The downsides are real. Saltwater corrosion is relentless. Every piece of equipment aboard those ships is exposed to salt air 24/7, even inside the holds. The Navy has to run dehumidification systems constantly, and even then, corrosion is a bigger problem than in land-based storage. There's also piracy risk. Diego Garcia is remote, but these ships transit through some dicey waters. And the biggest operational limitation, a maritime prepositioning ship takes 7 to 14 days to reach a port and unload. So you've traded the political friction for a time penalty.
7 to 14 days is a lot better than 3 months, but it's a lot worse than 96 hours.
That time gap is one of the central challenges of the Pacific Pivot. The distances in the Pacific are 3 to 4 times greater than in Europe. A C-17 flying from Travis Air Force Base in California to Japan takes about 12 hours with aerial refueling. An MPS sailing from Diego Garcia to the Philippines takes 2 weeks. The Army is now building a new APS set on Guam. That's going to be APS-6 eventually. And they're exploring what they call theater distribution hubs in Australia and the Philippines. But the geography is brutal.
The Pacific is just bigger. You can't logistics your way out of the size of an ocean.
Which is why the Army is rethinking the entire model for the Pacific. In Europe, APS works because the distances are manageable and the infrastructure is excellent. Highways, rail networks, deep water ports, all within a few hundred miles of the storage sites. In the Pacific, you're dealing with island chains separated by thousands of miles of open water, limited port capacity, and potential adversaries with anti-ship missiles that can reach out hundreds of miles.
A warehouse in Guam is great, but if the fight is in the South China Sea, you still have to move all that gear a long way through contested waters.
That's driving interest in what the Army calls prepo in a box. Containerized, modular equipment sets that can be airdropped or moved by smaller, faster vessels. Instead of storing a full brigade in one giant warehouse, you disperse smaller packages across multiple locations, making them harder to target and faster to deploy. It's the logistics equivalent of not putting all your eggs in one basket.
Dispersed, hardened, mobile. That's a very different philosophy from the giant climate-controlled warehouse in Belgium.
It's still mostly experimental, but the threat environment is changing fast. Hypersonic weapons can hit a fixed warehouse with very little warning. Long-range precision strikes. We've seen Russia use these extensively in Ukraine against ammo depots and logistics hubs, mean that a known fixed storage site is a target in a way it wasn't 20 years ago.
That raises an interesting question about the Middle East set. APS-4 is in Kuwait, right?
APS-4 is headquartered at Camp Arifian, Kuwait. It's been the workhorse for U operations in the region since the Iraq War. During the 2021 Afghanistan withdrawal, APS-4 equipment was used to backfill units that had been deployed, and some gear that couldn't be extracted was destroyed to prevent capture. That's the dark side of preposition stocks. If a site is overrun, you have to be prepared to destroy billions of dollars of equipment rather than let it fall into enemy hands.
Like abandoning a ship.
The Army has demolition plans for every APS site. It's not something they talk about publicly in detail for obvious reasons, but the doctrine is clear. If a site is about to be compromised, the caretaker force, which is mostly civilians and contractors, by the way, is supposed to execute a demolition plan that renders the equipment unusable. Thermite charges on tank barrels, incendiaries in ammunition bunkers, that sort of thing.
Civilians with thermite charges. That's a job posting you don't see on LinkedIn.
In practice, the caretaker force would evacuate and the demolition would be handled by a military security element, but the point stands. These sites exist in a weird limbo between peacetime and wartime, and the people maintaining them are acutely aware that their workplace could become a front line with very little notice.
Let's talk about APS-5 in the Pacific. You mentioned South Korea and Japan.
APS-5 is split between South Korea and Japan, and it's the most forward deployed of all the land-based sets. The South Korea component is stored at Camp Carroll and Camp Humphreys, and is designed to support a fight on the Korean Peninsula with essentially zero warning. The equipment there is maintained at the highest readiness level of any APS set because the threat is so immediate.
North Korea being right there does concentrate the mind.
The Japan component is more about regional contingency, supporting allies and responding to crises across the Western Pacific. And this is where the host nation politics get really interesting. South Korea and Japan both have strong domestic constituencies that are uncomfortable with large permanent U. Preposition stocks are a way to maintain capability without increasing the visible footprint. A warehouse full of tanks generates fewer protests than a base full of soldiers.
Tanks don't go to bars and cause incidents.
That's genuinely part of the calculus. Prepositioned equipment is politically quieter than stationed troops. It's one reason the model has endured through multiple administrations of both parties. It's a way to maintain forward presence with less political friction.
What does all this mean for the average taxpayer, or for the soldier who might one day rely on this equipment?
Let's start with the soldier. If you're an armor crewman in the 1st Armored Division at Fort Bliss, Texas, and you get the call to deploy to Eastern Europe, you're going to fly commercial or on a chartered airliner to Ramstein Air Base in Germany. From there, you bus to Mannheim or Zutendal. You walk into a warehouse, and there's your tank. Same model you trained on, same configuration, maintained to the same standard as your home unit's equipment. In theory, you draw your tank, do a quick systems check, load your ammunition, and you're rolling east within 48 hours of landing. In practice, there are always hiccups. The GAO report I mentioned found that some units drawing APS equipment during exercises discovered that the software versions on their tank's fire control systems didn't match what they'd trained on, or the radio crypto wasn't current, or the vehicle had a persistent hydraulic leak that hadn't been fully resolved. These are fixable problems, but they eat into that 96-hour clock.
Software version mismatches on a tank. It's like plugging in your laptop at a conference and discovering the projector needs a dongle you don't have, except the dongle is a fire control system and the conference is a war.
The fix is not a quick download. Military vehicle software updates often require physical access to the vehicle, specialized diagnostic equipment, and security protocols that prevent unauthorized modifications. It's a deliberate, slow process by design, and it doesn't always keep pace with the software versions deployed to home station units.
The equipment is maintained mechanically, but there's a digital readiness gap.
That's one of the findings buried in the GAO report. The Army is aware of it and is investing in over-the-air update capabilities for vehicle software, but it's a work in progress. The broader point is that APS is not a set-and-forget system. It's a living, breathing logistics operation that requires constant funding, constant staffing, and constant political will to maintain.
The funding part. You mentioned $1.2 billion for modernization. What's the total annual cost of running the APS program?
The Army doesn't publish a single, consolidated APS budget line that covers everything: maintenance, personnel, facilities, ammunition rotation, and modernization. But various GAO and Congressional Research Service reports over the years have pegged the total annual cost in the range of $2 to $3 billion. That's roughly what the Marine Corps spends on its entire aviation program in a year, just to keep parked tanks ready for a war that everyone hopes never happens.
That's either a great insurance policy or an enormous waste, depending on whether the war happens.
That's the fundamental tension. APS is insurance, and insurance always feels expensive until you need it. The counterfactual is the 1990 Gulf War, where the U had to ship everything from the continental United States to Saudi Arabia. Operation Desert Shield took 6 months to build up sufficient force before Desert Storm could begin. 6 months of shipping tanks across the ocean while Saddam Hussein sat in Kuwait. If Iraq had pushed into Saudi Arabia during those first few months, the outcome could have been very different.
APS exists because Desert Shield was terrifying.
That's the origin story, yes. The Cold War era preposition stocks in Europe were about stopping a Soviet blitzkrieg through the Fulda Gap. The equipment was positioned so that reinforcing divisions could fall in on their gear and fight immediately. After the Cold War, the program shrank, then got revived and expanded after Desert Shield demonstrated how slow sea lift really is. Today's APS architecture is a direct descendant of those lessons.
What about the comparison to other countries? Russia has forward storage too, right?
Russia has what they call forward storage bases in Belarus and Crimea, and they're a useful cautionary tale. Russian preposition stocks have suffered from chronic underfunding, poor maintenance, and outright pilferage. During the 2022 invasion of Ukraine, Russian units drawing equipment from storage discovered that engines had been stripped for parts, fuel had been siphoned and sold on the black market, and tires had rotted. There are documented cases of Russian tanks breaking down within hours of being drawn from storage because the batteries were dead and the fuel was contaminated.
The diesel bug wins again.
It's not just equipment condition, the entire maintenance culture matters. System works because there's a professionalized, well-paid civilian and contractor workforce that treats equipment maintenance as a career. The Russian system relies on conscripts and underpaid officers who have every incentive to sell spare parts on the side. It's a reminder that preposition stocks are only as good as the people maintaining them.
Advantage isn't just the equipment. It's the 2,000 civilians in Belgium who actually care whether the tank starts.
That workforce is aging. The Army has been warning for years about a shortage of skilled maintenance personnel, both in uniform and in the contractor base. Maintaining an Abrams tank isn't something you learn in a weekend. It takes years of experience to diagnose a turbine engine problem or rebuild a track tensioning system. If that expertise retires without being replaced, the readiness numbers get worse.
What about the transportation bottleneck you mentioned? Even if the gear is perfect, you still have to get the soldiers there.
This is the part that keeps strategic planners up at night, has about 220 CC-17 Globemasters and about 50 CC-5 Galaxies. Those are the only aircraft that can carry heavy equipment. But even for an infantry brigade that's flying in to fall in on preposition gear, you still need to move about 4,000 soldiers plus their personal equipment. That's roughly 100 C-17 sorties just for the personnel, assuming you're not also moving any vehicles.
The C-17 fleet isn't getting any younger.
The average C-17 airframe is over 20 years old, and they're flying more hours than originally planned. The Air Force has been sounding the alarm about airlift capacity for years. In a major conflict scenario, say simultaneous crises in Europe and the Pacific, the airlift fleet would be the single biggest bottleneck. You can have all the preposition tanks in the world, but if you can't get the crews to them fast enough, they're just expensive museum pieces.
The 96-hour promise is really a best-case scenario with no competing demands and perfect weather.
A cooperative adversary who isn't shooting at your airfields or jamming your communications. Real-world exercises consistently show that the timeline stretches under stress. The Army knows this, which is why they're investing in alternatives. Faster sea lift, pre-positioning smaller equipment sets closer to potential flashpoints, and experimenting with autonomous ships that could loiter near contested areas without risking crews.
Autonomous floating arsenals. That's either brilliant or terrifying.
A bit of both, which is usually where the interesting ideas live.
What can someone who's interested in this actually do to stay informed? Where do you track whether APS is working or falling apart?
Two things to watch. First, the Army's annual budget request, specifically the APS modernization line item. For fiscal year 2027, the request is $1.2 billion. If that number goes up significantly, it signals that the Pentagon sees preposition stocks as a growth area, probably tied to Pacific deterrence. If it gets cut, that tells you something about shifting priorities. Second, watch for new basing agreements in the Pacific. The Army is quietly negotiating with Australia, the Philippines, and several other countries about hosting prepositioned equipment. Those agreements rarely make front-page news, but they're the leading indicator of where the next APS site will be.
Follow the basing agreements. That's a very concrete way to track strategic intent without needing a security clearance.
The GAO reports are public. GAO 25-210-6487 is available online, and it's surprisingly readable. These reports come out every few years and give you an unvarnished look at readiness rates, maintenance backlogs, and the gap between what the Army says and what's actually happening on the ground in Mannheim or Zutendal.
The big open question, as hypersonic weapons and long-range precision strikes make fixed bases increasingly vulnerable, does the whole APS model become obsolete, or does it evolve into something more distributed and survivable?
I think the fixed warehouse model in Europe has maybe another decade before it needs a fundamental rethink. The Pacific is already forcing that rethink. What's emerging is a hybrid approach. Keep the big warehouse complexes where the threat environment allows it, but supplement with smaller, dispersed, mobile stockpiles that are harder to target. The Army's prepo in a box. Experiments are the early prototype of that. Containerized equipment sets that can be moved by truck, ship, or aircraft on short notice, stored in hardened bunkers or even underground, and configured so that a unit can fall in on them in hours rather than days.
Prepo in a box. The logistics equivalent of a go bag.
It blurs the line between a warehouse and a forward operating base. Instead of one giant site with three brigade sets, you might have a dozen smaller sites, each holding a battalion's worth of gear, scattered across multiple host nations and connected by a logistics network that can surge in any direction. It's more complex to manage, but it's also much harder for an adversary to neutralize with a single strike.
More moving parts, but no single point of failure.
Which is the direction military logistics has been heading for decades, just accelerated by the precision strike threat.
From fold the gap to floating container pods in the South China Sea. That's quite an evolution for a bunch of warehouses. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, linguists widely believed that click consonants in Khoisan languages were linguistic fossils, remnants of the original human proto-language, and a prominent theory held that click languages had once spanned Asia, with some scholars claiming to have found evidence of clicks among isolated populations in Mongolia. The theory collapsed by the early 20th century when fieldwork revealed no such evidence, but for about 30 years, respectable journals treated Mongolian click languages as a plausible discovery waiting to happen.
Right. The takeaway for anyone listening, the U Army's preposition stocks are real. They're massive. They're meticulously maintained at enormous cost, and they're the invisible backbone of every rapid deployment headline you've ever read. They're also fragile in ways that don't make the news, vulnerable to neglect, political shifts, and the simple fact that salt water eats everything eventually. The next time you hear about troops deploying to Eastern Europe in a week, remember the 2,000 civilians in Belgium who made that possible.
If you want to go deeper, we've covered the broader military logistics system and the life cycle of military equipment in past episodes. The links are on the website.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show.
Until next time.
We'll be here.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.